So tomorrow's daf and daf yomi. Bava Metzia daf, Nun Tes, has one of the most famous, one of the most iconic stories in the entire Gemara, in the entire Bavli, and that is the story of the Tanur Shel Achanai. So, because Erev Shabbos Chol Moed, Pesach, Tavshin Pei Dalid, and because Tanur Shel Achanai is coming up tomorrow, I figured, okay, let's do a short episode on Tanur Shel Achanai and some of the ideas, and see where that goes. So, the context is the sugya of Ona'a, right? Where the sugya of Ona'a is mistreatment with words, saying not nice things. This is where it talks about Malbim Pnei Chavero, embarrassing someone, making someone feel bad, dishonoring a person with words. That's the sugya here. And it's very much, I mean, the reason that this story ends up in this sugya is because of what happens to Rabbi Eliezer. It's not just that Rabbi Eliezer, okay, spoiler alert, we don't go according to Rabbi Eliezer, but that Rabbi Eliezer was considered mistreated, and that there was concern that if he ever said tachanun, that if he ever said anything to, if he ever davened properly, that that Rabban Gamliel would actually die, and so Ima Shalom, Rabbi Eliezer's wife, who was the sister of Rabban Gamliel, she made sure that Rabbi Eliezer, for the rest of his life, didn't say Tachanun, because he was insulted and he was dishonored and he was. That's the envelope here. That's what brings it in, right? And it's, you know, even though the philosophy of halacha, that aspect of the story, is something which is what gets the most play, right? This is how it actually gets here. And this is pointed out by Jeffrey Rubinstein in his book on Agada. He has a chapter on Tanur Shel Achanai, and he emphasizes this point. Okay, but already in the time of the Rishonim, already in the Sefer Achinuch, possibly even before the Sefer Achinuch, you know, it wasn't just this whole idea of Loba Shamayim Hi and like the emphasis of it and the idea that this is like a key tenet of halachic theology and halachic philosophy. It's not something that was just made up in the last, you know, 200 years, even though it seems like it, because this is, you know, if you learn 10 Gemaras, this is one of the 10 Gemaras that you learn, right? And if you went to some summer camp where it's like an introduction to Talmud and they do 10, you know, little pieces of Talmud, this is one of them, possibly even the first one. But the emphasis on this doesn't start recently. It doesn't start right in the modern era. Already the Sefer HaChinuch, when he's talking about Al Pi HaTorah Asher Yorucha, he talks about Tanur Shel Achanai. And he talks about the, you know, what it means, its implications for the halachic system and the development of the halachic system. Okay, so that stuff I'm gonna steer away from it. I feel like that's done and overdone, and you don't need me to tel you about what it says in Tanur Shel Achanai and the, you know, and the philosophic and theological implications of it. Let's go through the story quickly, just so that we have it. Clear. There's a Mishnah in Caleb, Perek Hey, Mishnah Yud, Chotcho Chulios. If you took an oven and you cut it into strips, into segments, and also on Chol Ben Chulil Chulia, and you put sand in between each of the segments, and then I guess you refire it, meaning you reconstitute it somehow. Rabbi Eliezer says it's Tor, B'Chachamim Mitamin, and the Chachamim say it's Tameh. We're going to circle back to the Mishnah, because I think that the Mishnah is really important, right? In general, I think that whenever you have halacha embedded in an agadic sugya, the halachic sugya is very important. The halachic sugya contributes a lot to what's going on in the agad. Okay, v'zehu talar shel achanai. This is the tanner of the oven of achanai, right? Achanai is a kind of snake. Right, and you can imagine, right? It looks, It almost looks like an old school beehive, like in the Utah state emblem, or it looks like a coiled snake. That's what it looks like. But the Gemara says, Mayachnai, why is it named for a snake? Amar Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Sheyikivu Dvarim ba'achnazu, ke'achnazu v'tim uhu. That the rabbis surrounded Rabbi Eliezer with like a snake and called it tameh, right? Rabbi Eliezer is the one that says it's tahor, and the Chachamim say it's tameh. Right now, tameh here means that it's a bona fide kli, right? It's a real kli. It has the status of a real kli. Only a real kli is tameh. Something which is not a real kli is not mekabel tuma. It's tahor. Okay, Rabbi Eliezer says it's not a real kli. The Chachamim say it is a real kli, and therefore it's mekabel tuma. So Tana, we have a brisa. But also Yom Heshiv Rabbi Eliezer kol shuv b'shava olam. Rabbi Eliezer answered them in every way. Lo kiblu imenu. They didn't accept it from him. And then he gives his three proofs. If halacha is like me, let this carob tree prove it. And the carob tree uproots itself, and it goes 100 amos. And some say 400 amos. And then they said to him, no, you can't bring a raya from a carob tree. Then he says, if the halacha is like me, let this water channel, let this little irrigation canal, let it prove it. And the water started flowing backwards. And they said to him, no, you can't bring a proof from this water channel. Chazar v'amar lehem, then he said, let the Beis Medrash prove it. Okay? Let the Beis Medrash prove it. He took Kosli Beis Medrash lipol, and the walls of the Beis Medrash were going to cave in. Gor b'hem Rabbi Yehoshua rebuked them and said, "In Talmidei Chachamim and askum zeh zeh b'halacha. If we're fighting each other, if the Talmidei Chachamim are fighting each other on a halachic matter, atem mativchem. What does this have to do with you? Right? What, you know, you have no standing here. No pun intended. This has nothing to do with you. Stay out of it." So they didn't fall, and they didn't stay straight, and so they remained crooked. And Rabbi Adayin Matin Va'omdin, they're still crooked. Chazar Va'omdalehem, and then he says, you know, and here's the punchline. Im Halacha Kamosi, if the Halacha is like me, Min HaShamayim Yochichu, let the heavens prove it. And then a baskel comes out and says, Malachem Eitzel Rabbi Eliezer, Shalacha Kamosi B'chol Malkom. What do you have against Rabbi Eliezer? The Halacha is like him always, everywhere. Okay, Amar Rabbi Yeshua Raglav Amar. Rabbi Yeshua stands up and says, "Lo b'shamayim hi." It's not in the heavens, right? So that's a pasuk in Parshas Nitzavim, right? Lo b'shamayim hi. The Torah is not in heavens. You gave it to us. The Gemara asks, "My lo b'shamayim hi." What does that mean? Amar Rabbi Yirmiya shekvar nitna Torah me'arzina. The Torah was given. Inanu mashkichem bebaskol. Right? We don't listen to. Right? There's no longer any heavenly intervention in the halachic process. Once the Torah is given, there's no halachic, there's no heavenly intervention in the halachic process. Now that issue is a fraught one, and there are definitely times, you know, like there are, I can think of offhand a whole bunch of, we'll just bring one, that's me and Yana de Yoma, the question of whether, I think it's saying, the question of women saying, making a bracha on mitzvah seshei shazman grama, right? So this is a machlokas famously between Rabbeinu Tam and the Rambam, where Rabbeinu Tam says women can make a bracha on mitzvah seshei shein hazman grama, right? Like sukkah or lulav, and Rambam says no, they don't. And Shelos Uchos Min HaShemayim Paskins like Rabbeinu Tam because he had a dream. And the Chida says, like, well, you know, that tips the scales in favor of Rabbeinu Tam. And that's actually what he Paskins, right? So there are times, there are areas of halacha where these things come up, right? It's on Sukkos, I have a whole bunch of examples. Maybe we'll do that an episode Sukkos time. Just on Sukkos, the examples of where Baskol comes into the halachic process, or Baskol or semi-prophetic things that are ex machina, right? So Rabbi Yirmiya is saying, right, there is no ex machina. Everything is part of the system now. We don't listen to a Baskol, right? Shekvar kasavta b'har Sinai b'Torah, you wrote in the Torah in Har Sinai, acharei rabim lahatos, right? You follow the majority. Now, many have pointed out that that pasuk is taken out of context there, right? It's lintos acharei rabim lahatos, that it's not exactly, the pasuk isn't saying that you shouldn't find a majority, you shouldn't lotia acharei rabim lura'os, you don't follow the majority in order to do wrong, lotana al riv lintot acharei rabim lahatot, or you shouldn't give perverse testimony in a dispute so as to pervert it in favor of the majority, right? So it's like, but it's just kind of taking those three words out and saying acharei rabim lahatos. Ashkechei Rabbi Nathan le'Eliyahu, right? And now, so fine. So now you say that acharei rabim lahatos, we have this pasuk where we learn out that we follow the majority, even if it goes against what God, as it were, himself wants. Ashkechei Rabbi Nathan le'Eliyahu, Rav Nosson finds Eliyahu, Amar le, my ovid kutcha brichu b'chayi shaita, what was God doing at the time while they were arguing? Amar le, kachiech v'yomar, he was smiling and he said, Nitzchuni madayim, nitzchuni banai, my children have triumphed over me. My children have triumphed over me. Now most people will end it there. That's all we talk about, right? Meaning that's the end of the story, nitzchuni banai, we prevail over God. You know that halacha is now in human hands, it's no longer in divine hands, and it's up to us. That's not where the Gemara ends. The Gemara says, Amru, Oso Ayomi Vyu, Kola Taros Shatir Rebbe Eliezer Vesarfum Ba'esh. That day, they took all of the Taros that Rebbe Eliezer was Mitaher and that the Chachamim thought were Tameh, Vesarfum Ba'esh, and they incinerated them. They piled them on and they made this giant bonfire, right? Lag Ba'omer style. V'nimnu Alavu Verchuhu, and they reached a consensus. And they cursed him. They ostracized him. Va'amru mi'elich v'yodiyo. And then they said, okay, who's going to tell him? Amar lam Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, who was his student, along with the student of Rabbi, who was also a student of Rabbi Yehoshua, he said, I'm going to go. Ani yelech. Shema yelech adam sh'eno hogun v'yodiyo. Because he didn't want somebody that was not right for the job to go and let him know. Imtzum machriv eskolo olam kulo, because that could destroy the world. Meaning they wanted to handle Rabbi Eliezer with kid gloves. They knew that he was very powerful and that he was a great Talmud Chacham and that the guy, you know, he could call on miracles at will. So Rabbi Akiva is like, all right, I'm going to go. Ma'asa Rabbi Akiva. So what did Rabbi Akiva do? It's like almost like he's being Menachem Avel, right? It's like one of these, it's a very touching scene. Lava Shchorim and Nisatev Shchorim. He dressed in all black. V'yashav lefan of Berichuk Dalad Amos. And he sat down 4 amos away from Rabbi Eliezer, because you're not allowed to be within 4 amos of somebody who's been ostracized. Amarlo Rabbi Eliezer, Akiva Mayomi Yamayim. He's like, what's going on? Why is today different than any other day, right? Manishtana Hayom Hazeh. Amarlo Rabbi, he says, my master, Kimidum Elisha Chavirim B'delim Mimcha. It seems to me that your colleagues are distancing themselves from you. And Afhu, at that point, Rabbi Eliezer himself, Kara Begadav, he tore his clothes, V'cholatz Min Alav, and he took off his shoes, V'nishmat, and he got down off of his chair, V'yoshav Al Gabei HaKarka, and he sat on the ground. Zolgu Einov D'ma'os, he started crying. Laka Ha'olam, and the entire world was afflicted. Shlish B'zeisim, Shlish B'chitim, Shlish B'seorim, 1/3 of its olives, 1/3 of its wheat, and 1/3 of its barley. V'yesh Omrim, Av Batzik Shibidei Isha Tafach, right, the dough in a woman's hand spoiled. Tana, we have a brisa. Av gadol haya ba'oso hayom shebechol makom shenasan ba'u enov Rabbi Eliezer nisraf. Right, so it's almost like a story of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai's story. Everywhere he looked, right, it was incinerated. Everything he looked at was burned. Avraham Gamliel haya babaspina. Rabbi Gamliel was on a boat. We're going to get to boats soon because I don't think the Gemara is actually thinking of a particular boat here, but it's interesting that the Gemara does mention a boat here. Rabbi Gamliel was on a boat. Amar alav nachshol etavo, and there was a wave that was going to drown him. Omar, he says, k'meduma li she'ein ze ela b'shvil Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkanus. I think this is because of Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkanus. Omar al raglav, Omar, he stood up and he said, Ribono shel olam goy v'yadu alav necha shelo l'chvodi asisi v'lo l'chvodi b'yis abo asisi. You should know, God, that I didn't do this for my own honor and not for my family's honor, but only for your honor. Shalom yerbu machlokos bi Yisrael. So that there wouldn't be too much dispute in Israel. Noch hayam yizapo. And the sea calmed. And the story continues. Ima Shalom, we mentioned this before. Ima Shalom, Dvesu de Rabbi Eliezer, Achse de Rabbi Gamliel Havai, Mahahu, Maisa Ve'elach, Lohav, Shavkalil, Rabbi Lezer, Lemepal, Al Ape. From that point forward, Rabbi Eliezer's wife never let him say Takana, never let him fall on his face in prayer. Because she was afraid of what would happen, because we saw what would happen. We saw what happens when he's insulted. How Yom HaReish Yachav, there was a certain day that was a Rosh Chodesh. V'ichlach labin malei l'chaser. She got mixed up. She thought it was going to be a full month, a 30-day month, but really it was only a 29-day month. So it was one day Rosh Chodesh. She thought it was going to be a two-day Rosh Chodesh. So the second day, which she thought she was going to be a second day of Rosh Chodesh, where you don't say Tachanun, she forgot, and she let him say Tachanun. Ikada Amri Asa Anya V'Kaya Bava. Some say that, no, there was a poor person that came and was knocking on the door, a Pikale Rifta, and she was bringing him, she brought bread out to him. And then Ashkachte Denafal Alanpe, and then she comes back and she sees that her husband, Rabbi Eliezer, was saying Tachanun. Amrale, she said, Kum, she said, get up, don't get up. Kalatate la'ach, you already killed my brother. Adahachi, Nafach Yipurim, Yibizrong, and Mleel Dushachiv. And then they heard the news. A shofar came out. Shofar flask was blown from the house of Rabbi Gamliel, saying that he had died, right? And there are some interesting parallels here, right? The bas kol and the shofar that both come out and make this announcement, the three miracles that happen when Rabbi Eliezer is put in cherem versus the three miracles that he does to prove his point. So Amar la minaya dat, he said to her, how did you know? Amrale, she said to him, kach mekublanu mibeis aviava, I know this from my family's home, right? Meaning in her family is Rabbi Gamliel's family. Kol hasha'arim ninolim chutz mishare ona. And that's the connection to this sugya in Bava Metzia. All of the gates have been locked. All of the gates can be locked, right? And this is, remember, this is one generation after the Churban. That's also a point we're going to come back to shortly. All of the gates have been locked except for the gates of mistreatment, except for the gates of insult. That is the Gemara. Okay, what I want to do, I actually reached out to a bunch of friends, and some have answered. And I want to get into some of the ideas. I'm going to, they sent me voice messages, they sent me voice notes. I'm going to put those in, I'm going to embed them in the thing. So the first up is my friend, Rabbi Uri Goldstein of Beit Shemesh, an old friend going back close to 30 years already. And here is what he had to say.
Okay, al regal achat, no pun intended when you see what I'm about to say. A very meaningful phrase to me, or the phrase that I always come back to when I teach Tanu Rosh Hanachnai, is the phrase Amad Rabbi Yeshua al Raglov, right? Which is the last thing, before Rabbi Yeshua says Lo Bashamayim Hi, the Gemara says Amad Rabbi Yeshua al Raglov, and he announced Lo Bashamayim Hi. What's interesting is, I'm sure somebody must say this, but I haven't seen it anywhere. I also haven't looked at it extensively, is that the phrase Lamor al Haraglayim is invoked in the different stories where Rabbi Yeshua is castigated by Rabbi Gamliel, right? In the case of the Bechor, Rabbi Tzadok, and in the case of whether Mariv is a Rosh Hashanah Rechova, right? In both cases, when Rabbi Gamliel hears that Rabbi Yeshua took a position that's different than his, he says, right, Yeshua, Amar Araglecha. So in both cases, those other cases, Rabbi Yeshua is instructed by Rabbi Gamliel to stand on his feet and obviously be, castigated for having taken the position that he took. And in the case of Tanur Shalachnai, he, of his own accord, of his own initiative, stands on his feet before castigating whatever heavenly forces it is that was going to take a position on the debate between himself and Rabbi Eliezer. So I thought the phrase Lamor Araglayim is a phrase that, again, I'm saying this very briefly, that indicates the boldness inherent in the halachic tradition, right? In other words, in the story of Tanur Shalachnai, it's the ability of Rabbi Yeshua to stand up to Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer is, right, the person of tradition and of higher forces. He invokes Shemayim. He only relies on Mesorah, right? But Rabbi Yehoshua is a person who has the boldness necessary that becomes so carefully associated with, or so closely associated, I should say, with Torah Shebaal Peh. And so that we know how the story of Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua resolves also, right? That even Rabban Gamliel ultimately suffers because of his persecution of Rabbi Yeshua. So the phrase, you know, of Rabbi Yeshua standing on his feet implies the boldness, among other things, the boldness that is necessary in that halachic process. And just to sort of, you know, drive it home a little bit, there's a Gemara in Sanhedrin that says that when Shimon ben Shetach put Yanai on trial, right, for... because his servant killed someone, so Shimon ben Shetach says to Yanai, Yanai Amelech Amor Araglecha, right? So you have the same idea, right? Shimon ben Shetach being one of the characters who, in let's say, the rabbinic memory, is associated with the institutionalization of you want to call it Pharisaic law, Torah Shebaal Peh, whatever you want to call it. Yanai, you know, being a figure that's seen, I think, in rabbinic memory as being more associated with the Sadducees, and so the power of Torah Shebaal Peh is basically encapsulated in that phrase Lamod al Haraglaim, because it implies boldness, because it implies groundedness. A lot to say about it. That's sort of a like I said, regal achat, no pun intended version. And if you want to elaborate on the point in a little bit more time appropriate context, the fact is that the day that Rabbi Yeshua wins, i.e. the day of Rabban Gamliel's deposition, is also the day that Shir HaShirim becomes part of the canon. So again, putting this in a regal achat version is, you know, the day that somehow the appeal to humanity and human boldness and the human experience reigns supreme in the Rabbinic Academy, is a day that we can allow into the canon a book that seems to, you know, sort of very much focus on humanity, human emotions, eroticism, the human experience, as opposed to just saying, you know, Shir HaShirim is Kodesh Kedoshim, but that it actually, you know, is sort of walking the line between human experience and the sacred. And it's dafka on the day of Rabbi Yoshua's victory that book gets admitted into the canon. Okay, a little sort of hot take edition.
So thank you, Ruri of Yeshivat HaKotel and of Hamudim, together with his wife, Dr. Julie Goldstein, former JLIC rabbi at UCLA and former Rav in Fairlawn, New Jersey. So I like this idea of Amad al Raglav, and you also have it later in the story where Rabban Gamliel is Omed al Raglav, and that sort of puts these different, what it does, there's this concept of, there are different variations of it. Tzvi Septimus has this idea of what he calls the superstam, right? Or that there are certain keywords that are, you know, that appear in context of the same discussants and the same stories, and that the purpose of putting these words and these stories is to sort of draw them together, right, and to have us read them one in light of the other. And again, we can't do like a full reading of these stories al regel achas, as Rabbi Goldstein punned, but it's just useful to think of it in those terms, and especially since the question of honor features so prominently in both stories. The personalities are the same. It's Rabbi Akiva, and it's Rabbi Eliezer, and it's Rabbi Yehoshua, and it's Rabban Gamliel. It's the same players. It's the same stories. And these are the kinds of things that are going on. And Rav Uri also points out at the end in his, in that last clip, that this is also what's going on. That's the day that Shir HaShirim became part of the canon, right? That's the day that they decided to accept Shir HaShirim, is the day that they deposed Rabban Gamliel. So it's not like these are just dry, you know, disputants talking about the status of ovens. These are, in a lot of ways, they're romantics. Okay, the next person who responded to my, the next person who responded to my, to my call for voice notes was our friend and neighbor, Chana Lakshan Bob. So she's up next.
So Natan and I just came across something interesting that relates indirectly to Tanuro Shel Achnai when we were learning at Masachet Sanhedrin. On Daf Kuf Dalet Amud Bet, there is a story that really feels like the flip side of the Tanuro Shel Achnai story. It's a story where the rabbis are deciding who will get into, who ends up getting added to the list of people who don't have a chelek l'olam haba. And they try to add Shlomo to the list, and various miracles happen, and they ignore them. So it seems very similar to the Tanuro Shel Achnai story, where there's like a fire, and they ignore it, and there's a bat kol, and they ignore it, and David HaMelech appears to them, and they ignore it. But the thing that is different is that it has the opposite ending. That at the end of the story, God, there's a second bat kol that says, like, actually, you guys don't get to choose. I'm the one who gets to choose. And that basically the bottom line of Tanuro Shel Achnai is lo b'shamayim hi, but the bottom line of the Sanhedrin story is that this particular thing actually is b'shamayim. So that, even though, you know, that the story in Bava Metzia is a good example of the areas in which humans are empowered to, you know, decide the halacha and decide what's tameh and what's tahor, but that there are also areas where humans are not empowered to make the decision, and where, in fact, you know, when it comes to deciding sort of what's right and what's just in a much bigger kind of way, then actually the decision is up to God.
So Chana's contribution is great, and I should point out, Chana, she said she was learning with Natan, that's her son, who's the two of them together made a siyum on Erev Pesach on Masechet Sanhedrin. So I didn't go to that siyum, but whoever did go to that siyum, that was no cheapie. Sanhedrin is the real deal, especially when you're talking about what she was talking about, which is the last parak, the parak chelek, Kol Yisrael Yesham chelek b'olam haba, is one of the longest prakim and one of the most, it's just 30 blot of like straight agada, and it's wild stuff. And it's amazing stuff, and I can't wait for another, I don't know, two-thirds of a year, we'll get up to that in Daf Yomi. Anyhow, the point that she raises is a great point that, yeah, it's true, lo b'shamayim hi when it comes to halacha, but there are areas where it is b'shamayim, right? Kein b'shamayim hi. And she talked about, you know, literally, who gets into Olam Haba? That's a question that is Bashamayim, Kain Bashamayim. It also reminds me a little bit, and, you know, there are parallels with the stories of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, that the conversation at the beginning of Avodah Zarah, when you compare it to the conversation in Maseches Shabbos Daf Lamed Gimel, discussing Rome, where one of them is a very practical human sort of conversation. Okay, how are we supposed to relate to Rome? And then the other one is this much greater, broader, ultimate justice sort of perspective, like what should be Rome's posterity? Do they get to go into Olam Haba? Right, so that it's the same question there, and how you're dealing with it in a practical question, as a practical question, and how you're dealing with it in, you know, in some sort of cosmic justice sense are not always the same way of dealing with it, because otherwise you would say that, okay, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai in that Gemara, his approach corresponds to God's approach in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, so, like, conversation over, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai holds like God, like Rabbi Eliezer does in this sugya, in Tanur Shel Achnai, but that's not what happens in either Gemara, right? There are realms that are delegated to man, to humankind, and there are other realms that are not. So thank you, Chana and Natan, for that contribution. This next submission, a little bit longer than the other two, is from Professor Aaron Siegel, a professor of metaphysics at Hebrew University. Aaron and I have known each other for a little over 20 years. We were the same 3 years we were in Yeshivat Har Etzion. He post high school, I in the Kollel, and we were part of the same little chabura for a little while. And, you know, years later, he moved to Modi'in, where he lives today, and we're keeping it Modi'in. Modi'in is a boring place, but it has some very interesting people. The And I asked him to discuss a little bit of the metaphysical questions. And specifically, I brought up the Ship of Theseus. For those who are not familiar with the Ship of Theseus, it's a fairly well-known metaphor that goes back to the Greeks. And it's a question of, let's say, the metaphysics of identity. There was actually a really nice discussion of it on the last episode of WandaVision. And the Ship of Theseus is, Theseus has a ship. It's in a museum, whatever. One of the planks rots. They take it out. They put in another plank. They replace the plank. They keep on replacing planks. Now, all of a sudden, it's not, you know, there's not a single original plank left in there. Is it still the Ship of Theseus? If not, at what point did it cease to become the Ship of Theseus? That's the dilemma of the Ship of Theseus. Now, if you think about it, and this is, you know, I don't want to give too much away. I've been thinking about, I think about this sugya along these lines. Aaron sent me this article by Professor Eli Hirsch, who is amazingly the brother of Rav Moshe Hillel Hirsch. It's quite the family. And he writes about identity and kelim. Now, Maseches Kelim, and I think that this is, it's really very similar to the Ship of Theseus type questions. Throughout Maseches Kelim, it's really two types of questions, right? So you have an object. An object, right, is Mekabel Tumah, right? As we mentioned. An object is Mekabel Tumah. At what point in the manufacturing process does it cease to be, does it become an object that's Mekabel Tumah? Does it become a finished product, right? And if it's demanufactured, if it's decomposed, if it's broken apart, at what point does it lose its status, right? And sometimes those are not necessarily symmetrical, right? If you have a pot shirt, if you just have like a small piece of clay, that's not Mekabel Tumah. But if you made it into a kli, and now the kli shatters, and you have a piece that's left that's of a certain size, even if you, it could be that if you had made it that size from the beginning, from the outset, it would not be Mekabel Tumah, but now as something that retains the identity of that now broken former utensil, it is Mekabel Tumah, right? So the question is, this is the question of Maseches Kelim, at what point does something cease to be that thing? And at what point is it, and this is the phrase that that Eli Hirsch picks up on, at what point do you say it's panim chadashos ba'ulikan? At what point do you say that this is an entirely new object, right? Which is very similar to the question of the Ship of Theseus. Okay, so now let's look at the case of the oven of Achanai. What is the oven of Achanai? The oven of Achanai is, you take an oven, you break it apart, and then you sort of reconstitute it, but with other filler material in between. That's the case of the oven of Achanai, right? So now, today, now it's a functional oven, even though it's made up of material from an original oven plus other material. How do we relate to it? And that's the machlokas between Rabbi Eliezer and the Chachamim. Rabbi Eliezer says, it's tahor, meaning it's not Mekabel Tumah, meaning it's not the same oven. It's not an oven. It has not retained its identity. Whereas the Chachamim say, no, since all the parts are there, even though it was broken apart, you've reconstituted, you patched it up together well enough that it somehow retained something of that initial identity, and it is Mekabel Tumah. Okay? So now that's the Kalim Sugya that sort of forms the backbone of the story of Tanur Shel Achanai. That is the Tanur Shel Achanai. Aaron, who's really one of the smartest people I know, and I'm proud to call him a friend, and I don't have to ask him whether or not we're friends, like in that other podcast where they had a funny exchange about, are we friends? Maybe we're friends. Maybe we're not friends. Aaron and I are friends, and he's also a metaphysician. And he's also one of the smartest people I know and that I've ever met. And here's what he had to say about Tanur Shalachnai.
Yeah, so the Tanur Shalachnai has obviously been grist for the mill of lots of normative discussion about philosophy of halacha, about what halacha is and how it works. But the original case and the machloket is also a window into the metaphysics of halacha. And you know what halacha says about the metaphysics of things like ovens and other ordinary objects. Really all of Maseches Kelim, or a good deal of it, can be seen in that light as a way of investigating the metaphysics of ordinary objects. And I'd highly recommend Eli Hirsch's article, Identity in the Talmud, for anyone who's interested in investigating Maseches Kelim through that lens. But this particular question, this debate between Rabbi Eliezer and the Chachamim, is about this oven where the rings are cut and then it's reassembled, but with sand in between them. And the question is this object now capable of contracting tumah? It's important to note that, at least on the face of it, the question isn't about the survival of the original object. We're not asking whether the original oven survived. Do we have the same oven? We're asking whether there's an oven here at all, right? Or indeed, whether there's an object that's, you know, oven-sized and functioning as an oven at all. So according to the Chachamim, there is such an object, therefore it can become Tamei, whereas according to Eliezer, there is no such object. We just have Shvarim, we have Shivrei Kelim, these pieces, but they don't together make up an object, an oven. And the question is, what's behind this? So you could make a bunch of suggestions, I think. If you start with the position of the Chachamim, it seems pretty intuitive because these pieces are indeed functioning together as an oven, or they can, right? One can use them to do what ovens do. So, if you think that to answer the question of when do some things make up a bigger thing, you have to look at what those things are doing or capable of doing, then it seems like, as long as there are any ovens at all, which Halacha obviously thinks there are, then this would also be an oven, and these pieces would make up a bigger object that would be an oven because they're functioning the way that oven pieces usually do together. So what's behind the Shita of Rabbi Eliezer? And like I said, here I think you can suggest a number of possibilities. One would be that he's pointing to the fact that these objects, these pieces are scattered, right? They're spatially separated by the sand that's between them. And maybe he thinks that you can't have some things making up another thing if those things are separated, right? That they're not all in one piece, right? Which is an interesting position. We might think about it in general. Are the metaphysics of objects and the questions of composition, it has a lot of plausibility, but what about cases like, the pieces of your dining room set? We talk about them as one thing or as making up one thing, even though obviously they're scattered, they're spatially separated. Anyway, that's one possibility. I think the sugya in the Gemara, maybe this is a little bit more drush now, but maybe suggests an alternative understanding of what Rabbi Eliezer is saying, or what's behind his position. Because it's not just that the pieces are spatially separated or that they're scattered. It's also that even if they, bottom line, get the job done, they're not arranged and functioning according to like the original design plan for an oven. Like they're not like, the ideal design plan for an oven calls for these pieces to be together and contiguous. So it could be that it's not so much the spatial separation as much as the fact that the pieces, in order for some things to compose a bigger thing, and not to be just like a heap, as Aristotle would say, they have to be working together in the way that some sort of ideal design plan for this large object would have them working together. And that's what's absent. I think if you think of Eliezer that way, it might make sense of what's going on in the story here in the Gemara. right? Rabbi Eliezer is pointing first to a bunch of objects in the world, which, you know, each one is called upon to prove that he's right. You have the carob tree, you have the stream of water, and you have the walls of the Beit Midrash, of the study hall. It seems like, you know, we would identify each of these objects as objects, but it's possible that they're only recognized as objects because each of them, you know, is made up of parts, the parts of which are working together, you know, they're functioning together, not just that they so happen to be functioning together, but they're functioning together according to their original plan. Right. In this case, it's actually the divine plan to vindicate the correct halachic position. There's sort of all of nature, all of the objects, and not just nature, but, you know, even artifacts like the walls of the Beit Midrash, constitute objects in their own right if they're functioning according to this ideal divine plan. And then I think you have the same thing maybe regarding halacha itself, right? So he wants... or he sees halacha as a thing, as something coherent and existent as a system, insofar as it reflects some original divine plan. That's why he's calling upon a bat kol, right, which is going to be this voice from heaven that's vindicating it, because the voice from heaven is now going to be reflected precisely in the halacha and in the halachic system, and that's what gives the halachic system its unity. Whereas Rabbi Yoshua, right, and so therefore, right, I would just add, he doesn't accept majority rule, right? It's if you have a Beit Din, or if you have a number of chachamim, and some of them say one thing and some of them say the other, you can't decide halacha that way, because that's not going to be a pristine reflection of the divine reality, right? You just have some parts, like the two members of the Beit Din, or the majority of the Chachamim. Whereas Rabbi Yoshua, who, like we said, regarding the oven, is willing to just look at how these various pieces work. You know, bottom line, do they work or do they not work together as an object? They don't have to reflect or be operating according to some original or ideal design. So too, when it comes to halacha, that's the way he sees things, and he's willing to rely on Rov, and he says, we're not going to listen to the heavenly voice. Whatever the pieces down here manage to put together, right, the chachamim, individual chachamim, you know, working through the halachic system that they're developing and maybe patching together as they go, that's certainly, on his view, good enough for there to be a halachic system, for there to be a single thing called halacha.
So first, I take back what I said earlier. It's not about, as Aaron points out, it's not about the Tanur Shel Achanai retaining the identity of the original oven, but about a new identity, a new thing, a functional oven. And I really like what he says about how the question of the Tanur Shel Achanai is really sort of the meta question that's going on in this sugya, the question of halacha itself, right? Does halacha, in order to be halacha properly, does it have to, you know, to what extent does it have to be a reflection of, you know, that original, you know, God's original plan for what halacha is? As we see, the maskana is nitzchuni banai, and lo bashamayim hi, that the halacha does itself can deviate from what God actually wants. And if that's the case, then, you know, for Rabbi Eliezer, that it could be that that's really what he finds unconscionable, right? That the halacha itself should be, should you know, is not a reflection, as it were, of God's will, of what God wanted for the halacha, for halachic development, which is, I think, it's a very, very powerful way of reading it. In terms of how he reads the three signs that he gives, he called it drush, so I don't feel bad calling it drush. I have my own drush on that. I think it's, you know, what are the appeals that Rabbi Eliezer is making? You know, what kind of appeal can he make other than, you know, if he's not convincing them with his arguments, right? So there's the appeal of You know, the carob tree we know is a very slow growing tree. We know that from the story of Rav Rashbi. We know that from this, well, mainly from the story of Choni HaMa'agel, right? That it takes 70 years to grow. It's a very slow growing tree. And so what Rabbi Eliezer is saying is, and it's a generation, and the carob tree represents a generation, right? You have a, if you plant the carob tree, your children, your grandchildren will be the ones to have its fruit. And what Rabbi Eliezer is saying is he's saying that I did the best. Nobody was better than me at retaining what was from the previous generation. So you might have the majority, but I was the one, and we know, you know, Bor Sidshe, no ma'abed tipa, right? Rabbi Eliezer is the one who says, I actually remember and I actually am the one who has best preserved what the previous generations said, right? The second one is the water running backwards. That Rabbi Eliezer is like, I'm not just going with the flow, right? My position, right? You guys are a majority and I'm a minority, but you guys are all just going with the flow. You guys are all just going downstream. I'm going upstream. I'm going against the flow. My opinion is an independent opinion. I'm an intellectually independent person, and therefore my opinion should carry more weight, right? And then there's the Kotlei Beit Midrash, right? There's nobody that knows more Torah. It's a direct appeal to authority. And yet all three of these, and then finally the direct, what could be more objective than God himself saying, Rabbi Eliezer is right, and nevertheless, we go against him. So that's my drush, okay? It's my podcast, I get to say my drush as well. But getting back to the key point, which is that the Tanur Shel Achnai is actually a metaphor for halacha, right? So in my discussion with Aaron, in the texting back and forth, before and after his recording, I pointed out that I think he's right, meaning, and that's how I, without the philosophical grounding that he has, that's how I understand what's going on there and why Tanur Shel Achnai is the bone of contention here. But I also think that it's very specific to that generation. Meaning, if you think about what's going on in that generation, Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yehoshua, this is the generation of Yavneh, Rabbi Gamliel of Yavneh. This is the generation of Yavneh. This is the generation, if you look in the first Brisa in the Tosefta in Eduyos, this is the generation that they convened and were like, anybody that has what to say, they should come and say it, because they were really afraid that the Torah was going to be forgotten. They were starting to lose their grip on the Torah. They were starting to lose, there was a real break. There was a real rupture. And so they come, and very, the way that the Mishnah puts it, the way that the Brisa and Eduyos puts it, there's a very much a sense of we're trying, it's a process of reconstruction and preservation, reconstitution and preservation. That's the goal. And this is the launch of the project of the Mishnah, meaning the Mishnah begins, what we call the Mif'al HaMishnah, the project to start collecting and remembering and preserving various statements of various Tanaim from previous and future generations, begins there at Yavneh, okay? And Rabbi Eliezer looks around, and you have all kinds of people saying all kinds of things, and if you put it all together, it doesn't match what already happened. And now that's not even taking into consideration all of the historical changes. There's no longer a Beis HaMikdash. We no longer have an independent Jewish polity, right? This becomes even exacerbated a couple of generations later after the fall of Beitar. But already in that generation, you have very much a sense of loss, right? You have this move from Yerushalayim to Yavneh. We're talking about approximately the year 90, if we want to put a date on it, is when the story is set. The question of the historicity of the story is something that I don't even want to debate. I saw there was somebody did somebody wanted to suggest that, like, there was some sort of earthquake or tidal wave, and that the tsunamim actually correspond to, like, actual events of water flowing backwards. I'm like, do me a favor. First of all, there are midrashim that actually do talk about tidal waves, but that's, and there already, you might say that, okay, there are, that's based on events. because it's actually describing what a tidal wave looks like in Eretz Yisrael and in the Mediterranean. Here, it's a story, and I'm not going to talk about the historicity of the story. We don't need to talk about the history. That story doesn't need to be historical. The story is set in a particular generation. In that generation, this is what they were thinking about. Or the Bavli, which is where this story appears, several hundred years later, thinks of that generation in these terms. In terms of, these are the people that created the Mishnah. These are the people who sort of charted out a path for how the Jewish people and how the Torah can, how to reconstitute, literally reconstitute society around the Torah. And Rabbi Eliezer looks at it and is saying, this doesn't really match what we had before, you know. Sometimes, you know, some people held like this, some people held like that. And he was much more of a traditionalist. He wasn't, you know, he was the Bor Sidcheinum Amid Tipa. He did want to retain the past. He was part of the Shammai, right? He was a student of Beit Shammai who was more identified with retention, tradition, a retention of tradition and not with Chidush and not with the creation of new realities. And we know that Beit Hillel won out. And this is sort of one of the things that's playing out here in this sugya. How is halacha supposed to look? Is halacha supposed to be a mirror of exactly what was? And if it's not, then it's somehow defective. And you think about it, we can think about it in terms of Torah Shebaal Peh, which is what's going on here, but you can also think about it in terms of Torah Shebichtav, right? There's that famous medrash that Ezra HaSofer came and he took he found several manuscripts of the Torah, and he went after the majority, like Acharei Rabim Lahatos, right? It's the same sort of thing where Ezra HaSofer is choosing which text to use in his Torah based on what the majority of manuscripts that he found said. Now, the Medrash makes it quite clear that the final result didn't match any existing manuscript. The final result was something that was of Ezra's, I don't know if you want to say invention, but Ezra's production, Ezra's manufacture, right? There was no earlier manuscript of the Torah that said exactly, that had the exact same letters of what Ezra's Torah did. But this is the Torah that became the Torah. And you have a similar thing going on here. You have machlokes, and you have to figure out a way to resolve machlokes. And sometimes you have one person being made that this is what they used to do in the time of the Mikdash, and another person saying something else. Okay, and how do you chart through that? How do you figure out a way through that? And Rabbi Yehoshua is the one that says, well, you're right. There is going to be other stuff that seeps in. It's not all going to be original material. You're going to have the original oven, but you're also going to have all this other stuff that's going to accumulate, that's going to seep into, that's going to literally in the cracks, right? You're going to have to patch it over with things in the cracks. And Rabbi Eliezer says that such a thing is not a kli. That's not the halacha. That's not what the Torah is, right? And so Rabbi Eliezer says it's tahor, because this is not makabel tuma, because this is not what it is. Whereas Rabbi Yehoshua is saying, this is what we got. This, you know, we patched it together. The patchwork works, right? The patchwork of halacha, it works because it has to work because we don't have anything else. Because we no longer have nevuah, and we no longer have an urim v'tumim, and we no longer have prophets, right, and baskols coming out, and that's the irony of the baskol here, right? We no longer have this. We no longer have access to this. And if you look in the Gemara in Temura, I believe it is, right, that the question of lo bashamayim, he comes up specifically in the generation of Yehoshua and Osniel ben Knaz, which is also a generation that experiences this loss of direct contact with God. So here it's, you know, several generations later, it's like, well, we don't have baskol anymore. We can't rely on baskol anymore. All we have is this way forward of Acharei Rabim Lahatos, of trying somehow figuring it out based on consensus. And you're right, the ultimate final product, the halacha is not going to look like the halacha used to look. But this is what we've got, and this is the way that we go forward. So that's the reading. And Rabbi Eliezer, you understand where he's coming from, and you understand the hurt, and you understand the pain, and you understand the tragedy of Rabbi Eliezer. Because maybe he was right. Presumably he was right. And yet, the way forward, the only way forward, the only path forward, is the path forward that was established by Rabbi Yehoshua and Rabbi Gamliel and the other Rabbanim of that generation. well, basically, if you want to pose it as a Theseus-like question, the question is, this thing, this patchwork, this altered, reconstructed thing that we called halacha, is that the Torah? Is that the law of the Torah? Is that what? Is that the true ship of Theseus? Is that it? And according to Rabbi Eliezer, the answer is no. But Rabbi Eliezer, he remembered it all. And he remembered the previous generation. So for him, that could be his path forward. But that can't be a path forward for anyone else. The planks eventually have to be replaced. And so for Rabbi Yehoshua and for Rabbi Gamliel, that's, if you want this ship to sail, you got to replace the planks. And it has to remain the ship of halacha, the ship of, you know, the halachic equivalent, the halachic analog of the ship of Theseus. And that's why I wonder, as I alluded at the beginning, Rabbi Gamliel is on a boat when he says, you know, He's on a boat when he says that. Are Chazal somehow thinking about, you know, that this is the ship of Theseus, Rabbi Gamliel? He wants the boat to move forward. He needs the boat to move forward. He needs the boat to not sink. And so this is what he does, lechvod Shemayim. Is that what Chazal were thinking about? I don't know. I don't know how well-versed Chazal were in Greek myth. They probably knew some. But I think that we can put them together. We can think about them together in either way, you know, in any case. Have a good Shabbos and a good Moed, Moedim L'Simcha, and Shabbat Shalom. I will be in the States in a couple of weeks for Shabbos, and I will be in Oceanside for Shabbos in 2 weeks. And the Shabbos after that, I will be in London in the neighborhood of Barnet. So if any listeners want to get in touch and want to get together in 2 weeks and in 3 weeks, that's where I will be. Until then, Shabbat Shalom and Chag Sameach. Enjoy the rest of your Pesach.